And there were other physicists who did this work, who sort of started off working in air pollution and then got interested in, epidemiology and how viruses spread, who were trying to raise the alert from early in 2020, saying, look, you've got this wrong. So they were sort of absolutely baffled that the epidemiology community had this idea that anything infectious was falling to the ground, as if, as if it was incredibly heavy and was just going to drop, when they knew that the size of the particles that viruses are in is teeny tiny. And they're so tiny that they do something that's sort of slightly mind-blowing. So if you get really high-resolution photography, you can see that anything that is visible to the naked eye, even the tiniest, tiniest thing visible to the naked eye, is immediately under the effect of gravity, so it falls. But just anything just below what's visible to the naked eye doesn't do that. It's sort of mind-blowing, but it doesn't do that because as soon as it's out of your nose and your mouth, it starts to rapidly evaporate and becomes significantly smaller. And it's also in the warm air from our body. And so it goes up. So it's not falling to the ground at all. It's going up and it's lingering in the air. And so the kind of image I have of it is like Pigpen from Charlie Brown, where people are surrounded by this cloud of aerosols that they're producing all of the time, and they're being left behind as they walk down the street. And it then can move through the air from place to place. And so, this what that means is that somebody who's very sick at home and producing literally millions of virus particles and, tens of millions overnight, that material will get into the general air. And if it's at night time, there is no UV light around to do anything about it, it will move to their neighbors. And we've seen that happen with SARS-1. So there was a nice study in SARS-1 of an apartment block in Hong Kong where there were six tower blocks arranged in a sort of hexagon arrangement. And physicists predicted, based on people who were infected in the ground floor flats of one block, who was going to be infected next in the upstairs flats of blocks in the wind direction. And they got it right because that's how it spread.
It's so interesting for the development of just scientific ideas. So this miasma idea, where things like spread through the air, so you could smell putrid smells 100 yards away, and the disease spreads in these putrid smells. When of course we know it doesn't. This is what germ theory has taken over. But from that idea, we had this stereotypical idea of droplet infection. I mean, that's what we call it. These droplets, and they drop out. And the idea that disease could spread through the air had been chucked out in the sort of 1880s or whatever it was, with Louis Pasteur and Philippe Semmelweis, that therefore that can't possibly happen. But the physicists tell us about these aerosol particles, but they are spreading through the air. So the miasma theory wasn't completely wrong in that sense.
No,
We've gone
it
from
wasn't
we've gone to the
completely
opposite.
wrong. Yeah, that's right. So, I think the fact it was a smell was wrong. It was wrong. It wasn't a smell. But the
Correct.
idea that therefore nothing could ever travel through the air is also wrong. And once you've understood this principle, all sorts of things start to fall into place. So you start to understand why every region at the same time's got a problem. This is not what the modelling showed. The modelling showed it would start in sort of focal areas, largely cities, but they couldn't predict where it would begin, and it would spread out to more remote regions over time. And the modelling was suggesting that would take, weeks and weeks, like 14 weeks to reach a peak in every point of the country. Now that is nothing like what happened in the real world anywhere. In the real world, it was on, switched on almost immediately across huge areas.
Welcome to the FLCCC Weekly Update. I'm Betsy Ashton, Creative Director of this Alliance of Medical Professionals and their supporters. It's amazing what you can learn when you listen to what real scientists, independent scientists, have to say after they've examined data, carefully analyzed the data, the mechanisms of action, and studies that were well-designed and well-conducted, as opposed to narratives that push one belief or one product, but tell you little or nothing about it. John Campbell a superb nurse educator in the UK, listens to real scientists, as do we here at the FLCCC. You just heard Dr. Claire Craig, a consultant pathologist and fellow of the Royal College of Pathologists, tell Campbell about one of the big myths that we were all told about COVID going into the pandemic. Dr. Craig has written a stunning book describing many myths that were forced upon all of us by medical authorities who knew better or should have known better, and the sorry consequences of what those meant to all of us. And she'll be here with us tonight very shortly, and we'll be sharing her insights in conversation with our top doctors, Paul Merrick and Pierre Corey. Our nurses are already online to answer questions that you post into Q&A, and I'll bring many of them back for Dr. Craig and Pierre and Paul. But before we bring her on, Paul, Pierre, come on out here and please tell our friends out there watching how little time they have to, you know, sign up to join us in Phoenix. It's almost here, and why they really should come. Paul?
Okay, Pierre. Yeah, so we have our third conference is February 2 to 4. This is really going to be a revolutionary experience. It's going to be inspirational. It's going to be personal. It's going to be community. It's going to be the new direction forward. So we're really excited about this conference. It's going to be much more interactive. We have some new programs we're going to be releasing. So, you know, please, it's going to be, you know, the best one yet. Time is running out. So you want to register. And of course, you know, the giant Pierre is going to be there. So I'll be there with Pierre. And so, you know, this is the time to sign up.
Yeah, I'll just add, this is our third one. This is looking to be the biggest one so far. And, you know, we're trying to make it really positive, you know, no longer pointing out the faults and deficiencies and the corruption and all that, but really just focusing on what we need to do for ourselves, not only medically. You know, it is still partly a medical conference. We're focusing still on a lot of spike protein induced disease, but also other diseases that lend itself to repurpose safe medicines. And so there's plenty of medicine there, but also just a way to navigate and create communities where we can bring like-minded physicians and patients with similar interests and sensibilities and try to create a community. So we hope you guys can come down and join us. Don't waste any time, make the decision. 3 weeks away, let's go. Get down there, Phoenix.
Inexpensive hotel rooms are running out too. I think they've got only a couple more days to get into that block.
All right.
Take it away.
All right.
Yeah, so I just want to thank Dr. Craig for joining us. I recently read her book, which is mind-blowing. It changes, you know, Pierre's pretty smart. He picked this up pretty early on. I follow behind him. And so I was taken away by this droplet spread and believed this nonsense. And once you read Dr. Craig's book, it's really eye-opening or mouth-opening, because you realize what a complete myth it is. And it becomes so fundamentally important, as she will explain to us, because if you realize that the droplet spread story is a complete myth, and it's spread by aerosols, it changes your whole perspective of COVID and how to control it. And then you realize how stupid all the countermeasures were, because they couldn't possibly have they had any effect. So with that little introduction, Claire, do you want to just tell us the story? Because your story is really important.
Thank you very much, Paul, and thanks so much for having me on. I mean, to be honest, I think Pierre might have been ahead of me in this, because at the beginning, I fell for the droplet story we were all being told as much as anybody else did, but I just sort of, you know, kept reading and learning and started to sort of piece it all together. And the story really starts way back. You have to go right back to 1910. So in 1910, there was a public health officer in Providence in Rhode Island who was kind of interesting chap. He was slightly obsessive compulsive, I think. So when you read his book, you get to hear about how he doesn't like to go to conferences where other people are licking their finger and turning the pages of the book that he then has to go and touch. And he doesn't like touching the handles on the trolley carts that other people are using, or people might stick their thumb in his milk that he'll have to drink. So he has this obsession with other people's saliva and how he doesn't want it anywhere near him. But he also, to be fair to him, he also had this evidence that when you had patients on infectious disease wards, if you separated their beds, the transmission of disease reduced. And so he was really passionate about this, but couldn't get people to do it because everybody said, well, you know, they're going to catch stuff anyway. I don't see that that's going to make any difference. And so because he was very passionate about this, he started to become very evangelical in that he wanted people to stop completely these sort of hangovers from miasma theory, where people thought that the disease spread through bad smells. And so the hangovers, he used to refer to it as the sewer gas bogey. He wanted to rid the world of the sewer gas bogey. Mm. And so what he started to do was to sort of come up with these explanations that did not allow that in. So his explanations were that all disease spread, for every disease, he just put them all together, would be through saliva and through what he called mouth spray. And it was him in 1910 who came up with the idea that mouth spray would fall to the ground within 6 foot. So this is a very old idea. And it just sort of got adopted by public health people without them ever really testing it. They just thought, well, this sounds about right, we'll go with that. And when you actually read his book, there's all sorts of lovely, interesting aspects to it. Like, he talks about how at the time patients would be nursed and surrounded by sheets that were dipped in disinfectant and hung around them like curtains. And he didn't object to this, even though he could tell this was really part of the sort of belief in things spreading through the air, because it reminded the nurses going in and out that they should be washing their hands, because it sort of created that separation. And of course, we still use that idea in medicine subsequently. So, you know, he was important in terms of other aspects of disease, of infectious disease transmission. And he, in his book, towards the end, is very open and says, look, you know, I have sort of bunched all the diseases in together here, and that might not be quite right. And influenza in particular doesn't really quite fit what I'm saying. But, you know, this is just a starting place. So I'm laying down a sort of line in the sand. We can go from here. There'll be a lot to learn. And 100 years plus on, we haven't really learned anything. You know, literally this idea was taken up and not questioned.
That's like another theme in your book. And that's been a running theme on a lot of stuff I've learned in the last 3 years, is that you find that there's like these foundational concepts in medicine that are actually built. Like, when you look deep to see what's supporting it, it's not there. Either the science has changed or what we know is more, but the underlying belief doesn't change. And your chapter on aerosol transmission really laid that out, showing what people knew historically, and the resistance to accepting aerosol spread, right? Because it was so similar to miasma.
Yeah.
Claire, some people may not fundamentally understand the difference between droplet spread and aerosol spread, which is very important because they are fundamentally different. So just to summarize, the droplets fall to the ground and go about 6 feet. Aerosols can travel long distances, even miles. So it's so fundamentally different, the mode of transmission. Could you expand on that? Because it's such a fundamental concept, and I'm not sure that our audience understands precisely the difference between a droplet and aerosol spread.
Sure. So I think you've done a good explanation there. But what I try to do in the book is describe it by my making everything 1,000 times bigger, because I think people find it really hard to conceptualize tiny things. And I think maybe I found it easier getting my head around this because, you know, as a pathologist, I've been looking down a microscope for a long time. And so I have a way of thinking about tiny, tiny things and a structure to that. Anyway, so the way I've described it in the book is, if you have to imagine that I'm a mile high, right? So I've become a giant, I'm a mile high. My nostril's now the size of a bus. And at that size, a virus is just visible to the human eye. So that's the kind of scale of what we're dealing with. But the viruses themselves are not on their own. So they'll come out in liquid from your nose and your mouth. And the ones that fall to the ground are the size of grapefruits in that analogy. And so you can kind of almost picture, I think, if you know, the sort of 6 foot equivalent would then be a mile radius around me, roughly. And the grapefruits would sort of come out and fall to the ground within that radius, depending how loudly I was shouting or, you know, whether I was coughing. That's the kind of radius. Anything smaller than a grapefruit is going to be one of the droplets that will rapidly evaporate and become much, much smaller. And so be these aerosols, which then go up in the air currents and in the heat and can travel a long, long distance and remain suspended for a longer distance. So if you think about in the spring and the summer, when you see seeds from plants that are drifting off in the air and you just think, well, they're never going to land. You know, obviously they're under the influence of gravity, but even they're quite big in comparison to these aerosols. And so these aerosols really can drift and drift for a long time. And there's, you know, little sort of stories that sort of fit in with all of this. Like there was an occasion where foot and mouth virus, which infects cows, spread from France, about 38 miles over the land, and then right over the English Channel to the Isle of Wight and cause an infection there. So, you know, these viruses can spread a long, long time and still cause infection, because that's another sort of aspect of what we believed was true, was that ultraviolet light would kill all of these viruses. And, you know, I think maybe that is true, right? That is true. Yeah. But it's just, there isn't always that much ultraviolet light around. And at night, there isn't any. And nobody sort of kind of thinks, well, what happens at nighttime? You know, we can't just say, well, you know, you've opened a window, that's enough at nighttime, because it's not enough. But, you know, that's what could be when a lot of the spread is happening.
And Claire, so like you, I'm just going to summarize kind of what you said now and in the book, but you know, when we cough, sneeze, breathe, right, there's a whole spectrum of droplets. Some are large, right, and they'll not travel far. They'll fall by gravity. There's a lot of basically water in them. And then some are really tiny, and they float, and they can spread long distances. But it seemed like the response across the world was like hyper-focused on only have to worry about droplets, which has been the case historically, right? Wash your hands, clean surfaces. By the way, when you said that I was onto this issue early, that's somewhat true, but I also have to admit I cleaned my groceries before bringing them in the house. Not for very long, but I did do that. So
I will do a confession as well then. So in summer of 2020, I was picking out fabrics and making masks because I believe this droplet theory, right? If it is droplets, then you cover your face and the droplets aren't going anywhere. And so you can talk to somebody close up and you're not going to accidentally spit in their face. So, you know, with droplets, there is some sense in a cloth mask, but there's absolutely no sense with aerosols, none at all. And actually the N95 masks, so they're designed, when they're well fitted, they're designed to remove aerosols that contain viruses. And, you know, I think you can test them and show that when they're well fitted, they do that. But the thing is that when Germany and Austria mandated N95 masks, it really made no difference to the trajectory that they had. So that tells you that the masking itself isn't enough. So then you sort of stop and think, well, why wasn't that working? And there's a variety of reasons why it didn't work. So first of all, they might not be very well fitted, and people often, you know, that it will all, air will always take the path of least resistance. So a little gap. But then when you're taking them on and taking them off, you expose yourself. You know, it's like going, if you like, go into the sea with a snorkel on and you try and take your snorkel off and not get salty. You know, it's everywhere. You're going to get salty. And then you can catch it through your eyes. And then the real issue is that the people producing virus, the infectious risk, is from sick people who are at home. It's not from people who are walking about in the street anyway. So the virus is being produced in huge quantity by people who, you know, are just down the road from you, and it's getting out into the air. And there's not a lot you can do about that. And that's why it appears everywhere all at once at the beginning of an outbreak. and why, you know, it's over very quickly. Like all of the modeling said it would take a long, long time to go person to person until everyone's been exposed. But everyone gets exposed very, very quickly. And we know that we know the trajectory so well now. We've seen so many waves and it's the same every time. It's through the population and gone before you know it.
Yeah. So the fact that the virus can travel in jet streams and currents for miles is so completely fascinating, because then, you know, all the countermeasures, the masks, the lockdowns, the social isolation couldn't possibly work. Do you want to tell us the story about the boat that was at sea? Because I think if that's such a, it's such an impressive story, which illustrates the power of spread by aerosol.
And sure. And the base stations in Antarctica, which is a similar example. Yeah.
Yeah. So just to, before I go on to that, today in Fauci's hearings in the committee that he was in, he was quizzed about this and he said, he doesn't know that sort of that idea about close contact transmission just seemed to appear. It just appeared.
Wait, I'm sorry, anyway. Claire, can you, for me, maybe, hopefully I don't bother. What did you just say? Who said what?
Fauci is being, you know, at the moment he's in Congress, isn't he?
And what did he say to what question?
People were asking him, where was this idea about close contact transmission? Where did it come from? Where was your evidence for it? It just appeared. Anyway, so the story about the boat was an Argentinian fishing vessel where they will, this was like during the COVID period, they were testing before they went on their trip. So they were all on negative from tests when they got on board, and they were at sea for 5 weeks and then had a coronavirus outbreak. And then the Antarctic story was of the Belgian Antarctic base where they had done tons of testing, actually, because they'd had to do a kind of complex number of flights to get there. So they'd had flights and then isolations in hotels and then flights. And then they arrived and had an outbreak 2 weeks after they'd been there. So, you know, these are people who were very thoroughly cut off from the world. And this isn't a completely new idea. This is, so there's stories about colds, which are probably coronaviruses, in the being spread in the Antarctic research base back in the 60s. So, you know, these ideas that you can have this have been around, but they've always been, they've been one of those things where sometimes in science, some ideas aren't welcome. And that was one of them, you know, that just doesn't fit with what people wanted to hear.
What was interesting is, I read your chapter, I read that first chapter twice, but listening to the opening video, when you're talking to John Campbell, you cited a study, I guess, from first SARS, where they literally predicted who would get sick next because they knew the wind direction and they knew where, so that actually is true. Can you say more about that? That was in the first SARS?
That was in the first SARS, yep. So, you know, they knew it spread through the air and it was literally that. They had these sort of six tower blocks in a hexagon and they predicted where it would go when it went to these upstairs flats because it's going to go up. So, you know, in cities, what you have with air currents is drag, by right? Tall buildings, the air will go up and then as it gets to the top, it will hit the whatever wind direction it's going in. And then it will come back down alongside another building. So if I've got an infection, I live in a ground floor apartment. If I've got an infection in my bedroom overnight, it'll go out through my window and it'll just go up past all of my neighbors and then on its way.
So Claire, now let me piggyback on that question. I think, are you on the WhatsApp group with the folks who arguing that there's no novel? So you've seen some of that activity. Maybe some of the listeners have read my Substack on it, but my question is this: one problem that a lot of the debaters have is the how it spread, right? So it was really devastating in certain areas. You had these hot spots where hospital capacity was overrun, but then not far away, it didn't seem to have, you know, be overwhelming like a calamity. How much do you think what you're talking about now might explain some of those anomalies?
So I think the anomalies are really interesting. And I think, you know, those are the things we should be focusing on because that's how you get to better understand it. But the thing with coronavirus is they seem to behave like influenza. So we, at the outset, we were told effectively it would behave like measles, which would mean everybody who hadn't yet had it would be susceptible to an infection as soon as they were exposed to it, which has a completely different implication. But it doesn't behave like that. It behaves like an influenza. So an influenza will come in waves, and it, each wave will have that exponential growth and look like it's going to be an epidemic, and then it'll peak and go away. And so when we've had new influenza strains over the years, they will work their way slowly through the population over the course of a decade. And they sometimes skip a year. Like, you know, what's that about? Like, there's a lot about it that's really peculiar. And the people have, the person who's done the most work to really try and understand this properly was a GP called Edgar Hope Simpson, who worked in this little historic cottage in England, and he called it the Epidemiological Research Unit or something, but it was just this little cottage. And he would just study, he went through all the sort of historical documents of parish death records and things, just trying to understand how influenza worked. And he came up with this expression of a seasonal trigger. So that the expression of seasonal trigger encompasses a lot of different things, but it explains why you get these very sudden surges, why you could have the same virus being around with nothing much happening for a while, and then it just takes off. And obviously that's partly about exponential spread, but there's more to it than that, because these surges happen at predictable times of year. And which is why we always get, in the UK, we will always have peak deaths in January, because we'll have had a seasonal surge that came before it. And the seasonal surge sort of includes environmental factors that we don't fully understand around, you know, temperature and humidity and things like that. It includes aspects around the immunity of the population, and it kind of might include features around the virus as well.
But they and vitamin D, sunlight levels probably are in
there.
Yeah,
that's an interesting one. So people always grab onto that one as the reason for the winter being the worst. And it makes sense, and vitamin D is really important in the whole picture. But the thing is that our peak vitamin D levels are actually in September. And September is when it starts to uptick again each year. Mm. So it's more than just, I think it's more than just one thing. I think that's the key, is that there's to try and make it too simple, you lose something. I think you have to accept there's something we don't fully understand that causes these surges. And actually, when you go back to the data, there's one bit of data that really doesn't fit with the kind of story of viral attack that we're always taught, which is that if you look at the hospital population, in theory, if you've got sick people coming to the hospital and spreading disease there, then you would have peak virus at the point where you've had most of the admissions come in, they've exposed the hospital population, and then they all catch it. So you'd think you'd have peak admissions first, and then peak infections in the hospital community. But in reality, it's the other way around. So the hospital infections peak and are falling before the peak in admissions come in from the community. And I think that, so basically what you're seeing is that the hospital infections are peaking at the same time as they're peaking in the community, because the air is full of it.
Yeah.
And actually there was a nursing home study where they did genomics and looked at all the different virus sort of infections in an outbreak in Cambridge. And they showed that every type of variant that was in the community at the time was present in that nursing home population during lockdown, when everyone was doing their best to stay away from these old people, because it was in the air.
It was in the air. You know, one other, this might help you, because what you just talked about, how you would think when the peak admissions come, the hospital would be ravaged. One data point that Paul had from our early research is they would do viral cultures based on days from first symptoms. And this is in the first variant. The studies were showing that after about day 6 or 7, no culturable live virus was could be obtained from the COVID patients. So, and COVID patients typically were going to the hospital day 7 or 8. So that could be another factor of why, like, although there was this mad rush of admissions, you weren't, you know, ravaging the hospital. Because I think by then they were in the, like, what we call the inflammatory phase or the pulmonary phase, and they weren't really in that kind of acutely infectious, you know, viable virus phase.
Yeah, I totally hear you on that. And I think what's interesting about the hospital population is that their risk of infection was really high, like way higher than in the community. And, you know, obviously people are sick in hospital, so their immune systems are not working as well as they otherwise would be. And so patients in there for other things end up catching it at a far higher rate than if they were in the community. So the one intervention that I would support, and it's really only one, is UV ventilation in hospitals.
Yeah.
Because people are temporarily vulnerable. And the reason why I'd say that other things don't work is that once you appreciate it spreading through the air in that way, you have to appreciate one other thing, actually, which is that all of the measurements done by Public Health England for every single variant, where over the course of the wave, they measure the percentage in a household that become infected when someone's brought it home. And it's 10%. It's just constant. 10%, 10%, 10%, 10%, which means that only 10% of people are susceptible to any one variant. Mm. So once you understand it's 10% that are going to catch it, you know, eventually, and you understand that everyone is exposed, then trying to avoid it, you may, in theory, be able to put it off for a few weeks. But that mathematics of the trajectory shows a virus that has worked its way through that 10% with 90% of us as bystanders and is slowly picking off the last people in the tail as it dies away. And so, you know, it's just going to find you. And you might get lucky. I think, you know, the number of people that develop antibodies is slightly smaller than 10%.
But I wasn't aware of that. So you're saying that across multiple variants, they would do these tests, I guess, studies where they looked at households and looked at household transmission. And on average, from all the household they studied, it was 10% would then get affected. And that didn't change from variants, because it seems that some variants are more transmissible than others. Like right now, right, I'm like surrounded by COVID right now. It seems like everyone has COVID. And so like my perception is that some are more transmissible than others, but the data doesn't bear that out.
So with every variant, what would happen is at the beginning of a wave, the transmissibility would be higher than 10%. And at the end of the wave, it would be lower than 10%. And the average over the wave was 10%.
Okay.
And that meant with every new variant, they were able to say, oh, this one's so much more transmissible than the last one. You're like, well, no, but the same number of people are actually susceptible. But with what we've seen with Omicron is, because you've got a shorter incubation period, the 10% are getting it all much, much quicker than they were before.
Mm.
So the massive sharp surges with Omicron are a real thing. And I think it is just that shorter incubation period, which, you know, we talk about an incubation period as if it's person to person spread, but it might be more to do with the seasonal trigger making lots of people susceptible all at once.
Yeah.
So Claire, one of the stupid things that people did, and some of them still may do this, if someone has COVID, they would physically isolate them in the house so that they were treated like they were lepers. So they would be put in a corner of the house and people would avoid making contact with them and try and keep as far away from them as they can. So in fact, they were being socially isolated in their own house in an attempt so that household contacts wouldn't get COVID. But knowing what we know now, that obviously is stupid because it's just going to spread in the air.
Paul, what stupid doctor would give their patients that advice?
Did you?
Do you know any?
No, I know there's a Corey who did that.
Yeah, well, we had it in our public health guidance that was given to the general public. And I mean, honestly, that guidance was awful, awful, awful thing to do. Children were being, you know, treated terribly because of that guidance. There was one story I was told about a child whose mother died, and he or she was at boarding school, and they caught COVID and they were left isolated for 14 days after being bereaved. Like, this is completely inhumane. And there were other stories of children going into foster care where they were doing 14-day isolations on arrival in foster care in case they had it. Like, these children are, you know, vulnerable. They need you.
They need love, support, attention, warmth. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, Go ahead, Paul. You want to go ahead?
I was just going to, you know, we've spoken about the droplet myth and mass and social isolation. So there is another myth which is not directly related, but is so absurd that I thought you as a pathologist would maybe like to answer it, because it is doing the rounds and it's, I find it very distressing. This concept that SARS-CoV as a virus doesn't exist. There's no virus. No. It was all made up.
So I know. What Paul, it's like all the time I'm getting that, just all the time, to the extent that I think there are bot farms doing it, because it's so incessant and everywhere. So, okay, this is my answer to that. The virus model is a model in science which tells a story that explains the world that we observe. And that's all that we do in science. We make observations, we come up with a story that explains it, and we accidentally fill in the gaps and create myths along the way when we're doing that. So the virus story explains why people who share an environment become sick at the same time as each other. How those same people end up with RNA sequences that you can show on a test. And like, the tests have got problems, but you're way more likely to test positive if you are sick with this virus than if you are not. And the same sequence codes for a protein that you can also test for. And then you can test and they get antibodies to that protein that they develop later on. And, you know, there's so many pieces to this puzzle. I could go on about crystallography of the viral protein shapes that fit the receptor on the cell. And, you know, it's a complex picture that a viral model explains. Now, it might be that there are aspects to that model that can be improved upon, which is fine. And what people have got so hung up on is a combination of two things, really. One is the idea that they haven't isolated it as a virus. And I think that's true, they haven't. And I'm comfortable with that. You know, I'm comfortable. We haven't isolated quarks from a nucleus and we can still say that they fit a model that explains quantum physics. You know, you don't have to have evidence for every teeny piece of the puzzle. They haven't isolated it. And the other thing is there's a sort of a series of different experiments that have been done in virology broadly over the years. And these people are very good at, quite rightly, picking apart how those experiments have been done. Controls that were missing, controls that were done badly. And they do brilliant critiques of these papers, and I'm all for critiquing the papers. But you don't throw away a paper and then say, right, I've just destroyed the entire model. You can only remove a model if you can replace it with something better. That's what they need to do. They have to come up with a better theory that better explains the observations, and then they win. But that's not what they're doing at all. They're just on the attack all the time.
That's so well said there, Claire. That's kind of what you articulated what I was feeling this week in a lot of that debate, which is that they were trying to dismiss what we observe, patterns that we observe that don't have another explanation. And they're saying, we don't believe that it's happening this way. Well, then how is it happening? And then you get silence. So I think that's well said what you said. Yeah.
But, you know, going back to that debate and the Substack you wrote. So there's something that interesting that's just coming out now that sort of might bridge that gap a little bit. So we've got, you know, had this debate between some scientists who are saying if you look at when these surges were and how patchy the outbreaks were, all of the deaths must have been due to policy. And, you know, I think there are good arguments for there having been deaths from policy. Sure. But they're saying all of them were due to policy. And, you know, you guys are saying, well, we saw a virus, right? So there's this kind of conflict. And, you know, it's brilliant that we're still talking and it's all sort of, you know, we're trying to learn. But there's a little bit of evidence that I think might help bridge it, which has come out. We have Dr. Simon, he calls himself anonymously, has been digging through obituary data. So we've got, you know, a second data source for death data that is publicly sourced. It's like crowdsourcing the death data. And when he's looked at it, what he's found does not match the official death records anywhere. So actually, if you look across the world, almost every single country had a lack of deaths in January, February of 2020. And that doesn't happen. Like, you know, half normally would be under and half would be over. That, you know, that's sort of what an average is. But everywhere had a deficit of deaths coming into this. And then there was this massive spike in April, basically, in the Northern Hemisphere. And what he's shown from the obituary data is that actually there were winter deaths. There were plenty of deaths in January, February and March that were not reported in the official data. And the April deaths were on the way down. You know, it was like a normal winter curve that has just been moved in the official data to create this spring peak that actually was a, you know, so there was stuff going on before that April surge. It was already there.
This sounds, so the theory there is that there was widespread manipulation of data and suppression of death data in order to produce a peak?
I don't see how you can interpret it otherwise. I mean, you know, I like to sort of come at these from different angles and try and pick them apart. But when it's repeated and repeated in country after country and state after state, and you see that there was a lot of winter deaths that weren't reported, and then there was the spring was not the big deal they said it was.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of slightly disturbing, really, isn't it?
Well, I'm sure we have questions. I'll just finish by saying, I don't know when you got interested in aerosol transmission, but I was in New York during that, you know, spring wave, and I was with my mentor and we were chatting, and he started talking. I don't want to go into mass, but we did see, just from a clinical, we did see some protective efficacy of N95s in certain conditions, just in the hospital, brief encounters. We did think it protected us, especially around aerosolized procedures like bronchoscopy, intubation. We saw a lot of people getting sick before they were using them routinely. And then once we did, so I think it had some, but it was clear to us in hearing some of the cases like the Diamond Princess, all these things, that it was clearly aerosol. And you talked about how historically the concept of aerosol transmission took a long time to reach, you know, acceptance. But in this pandemic, as you know, I sent you that article. I'm sure you were aware of it. And you know Lindsay Moore because you cited her in your chapter. But there was aerosol experts and scientists crying from the sidelines, writing to the agencies, the WHO, the CDC, you guys have to consider aerosol transmission. And it took, a year and a half or 2 years before they even admitted it. And even CDC at one point, late 2020, they put up on their website that aerosol transmission was occurring. And on the same day, they took it down. And they said, it was a mistake. We didn't mean to put it out there. And that's a whole other piece, was why there was, I don't know if it's scientific ignorance or political resistance, but they were so slow to recognizing aerosol spread. And that has other, I think, contributors to it. But you know, I wrote that op-ed starting in April of 2020, trying to warn the country that there was aerosol spread occurring. I had citations of all of those super spreader events. The CDC had it in their weekly MMWR. I mean, it was a slam dunk, and it was accepted by the New York Times, but then dropped because of the George Floyd uprisings and whatever. But yeah, I mean, we called it early, and I published that up at the same month as the 273 scientists, their open letter to the CDC. And anyway, but I'm glad we're talking about it now.
It took until December of 2021 for the WHO to finally say long distance aerosol transmission was a thing. So that was just before Omicron arrived. And obviously that point, you know, there were some things that changed depending where you lived. I mean, there were still places that were in lockdown that winter for Omicron. So the point is that having made that statement, the implications of it just weren't really taken on board.
No.
You know, on the one, they're sort of saying, well, yes, and therefore we must do more. Therefore we must do more masking and more of everything, you know, because, and I almost think, I don't know if this is true, but I worry that some of the physicists who are trying to be heard learnt how to get into the journals and say these things. And, you know, you get heard by going along with certain things and saying, well, we have to do this and we have to do that. And then you sort of end up, so they ended up saying you've got to mask more because it's aerosolized.
You know, it's a, something very interesting here from one of our viewers that deals with this question, Pierre, that you mentioned about that the masks seem to help in the hospital situation. And this is, we had questions from several people on the efficacy of masks, but Dawn Thomas writes, she used to fit nurses in the Navy for N95 masks. She said it requires a tested fitting before using it. She said that She knew the normal masks were useless because the virus is extremely small and would pass through a cloth mask unimpeded. Can you tell our viewers how to fit an N95 mask properly?
Well, I mean, they come in three sizes. The way it's done at my hospital, it comes in three sizes, and you go for a mask fitting. And basically, they put this plastic hood that rests over your shoulders and chest, so no ambient air comes in, or very little. And then you put on the mask, and then they spray some very noxious substance, and they test whether you smell it. And so if you smell it, then that means your seal isn't good or the size isn't good. I've gone through a number of mask fittings. I'm a large, and every time I put one on, I can't smell whatever they're spraying in it. But that's effectively how it works. But that's under like that testing condition. I mean, in the fray of a clinical workday in an ICU, when you're putting them on and off and on and off, I mean, that does not match, you know, what's happening in the quiet of a mask fitting.
None of us at home had anybody doing that for us. You know, you just kind of throw it on as fast as you can and run out the door to whatever you're going to or wherever you are. So that's very interesting. And I don't think I've ever seen small, medium, and large. We just get
in the hospital masks from somewhere. In the hospital, they have them. Ah. And Claire, I read your thing on masks. I thought it was pretty definitive that they have little value. And I agree. I didn't believe in mask mandates, public mask mandates, wearing them all day, any of that. I thought it was nonsense. But I still have this, there is data to support. I still do think, I call it the four Ds, that a mask can reduce your chances, if it's a good mask, fitted N95, if the duration is short of exposure, the dimensions of the room are small, the draft or the ventilation is poor, and the density is high. So in those conditions, I do think for some duration, you can reduce your risk. But I think that goes away if you just do a study looking at people's mask wearing over days, because I think there's so many violations to the mask. And even as you said, even taking on and off probably will negate whatever protection you have. So I can't really say that strongly, but I will tell you clinically
I kind of agree that, you know, that if you've got a sort of super spreader event and you've got masking, it probably reduce the dosage and there'll be fewer people who are infected. Like, I do agree with that, that the point is that if 10% are susceptible and 10% are catching it by the end of the wave, then all you're doing is postponing it by a very short period of time.
Probably. And Pierre, that's an N95. Okay, yeah. To just make clear that it's a very specific situation, short-term use of an N95. All the other masks are useless. They're just completely and utterly useless and serves no purpose. And, you know, as Claire discussed in her book, the downside of masking, particularly of children, is devastating because, you know, you need facial recognition to communicate. And so generally masking is a complete waste of time. And so maybe, you know, I don't know what Pierre's holding up.
This is a framed copy of my op-ed from July of 2020, where I talk about aerosol transmission. And that I didn't pick that headline, but that was the headline they chose. ICU doctors say more of us need to wear N95 masks.
There you go.
So the problem, I mean, if you wear them, which they did in the hospital, you know, long term, then they became ill-fitting. I mean, you can get a good fit for a short period of time. But they were reusing, not only that, but they were reusing the same N95 for days.
Yeah.
So it became a stupid exercise.
And their eyes would still be exposed. And if you went to a hospital and people went and tried to find out where the highest levels of virus were in a hospital, it was in the donning and doffing room where people took an arm.
Oh, for sure. Really? For sure. Betsy, I have one quick question for Claire. Claire, is there real evidence, like strong, of ocular transmission? Or is it theoretical? And what does that study look like? How do they know it was the eyes?
Oh, gosh, you've really got me there now.
Because I've known about it. I knew there was a theoretical risk. And I don't know. I always dismissed it without real good reason. I just didn't. I don't know why.
It's a good question, Pierre, because how can you prove it? So you know what, Claire, you've got some homework to do.
Yeah, I do. I mean, that's the thing with all of it, isn't it, actually, is that with every exposure story, there are questions about really who gave it to who and what really happened. And so with the super spreader events, for example, do you remember the story of the choir where...
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That went around the world, that story. We all know that story.
Yep.
And it was reanalyzed last year with more information. And it transpired that actually it wasn't sort of one sick person in that room that made everybody sick. There were quite a number of people there who were pre-symptomatic. And you know that because they were sick the next day. You know, their incubation period was too short. So there's a lot of pre-symptomatic people all in the room together at a time when the community transmission was about to peak. So you've also say, well, how many of them would have actually got sick without going to choir, you know? And so that applies to all the super spreader events that we've had. The ones that we've got into the press more recently here were big music festivals where they could come up with a big number of people infected. But when you look at the percentage infected, like, well, that's the same as in the community anywhere else. That's not a super spreader event. And there was something really interesting about those meatpacking factories.
Yeah.
Where that story happened around the world repeatedly. And it may have been that there was something about the cold environment. But I think part of it was that when there was peak community transmission, everyone else is at home. The only people who were actually seeing each other were in these, you know, there were only a few occupations that were actually crowded, and that was one of them. But it may also have been the cold environment. I don't know.
Interesting.
Hey, Betsy, do you have some questions for Claire?
Oh, yeah, we've got a lot. Here's one from a viewer. It says, I read that maintaining a certain level of humidity helps reduce flu particles that cause infection. Would this apply to illnesses like COVID? Humidity versus ventilation, which is more effective?
So that's a complicated question, but there's some interesting aspects of the answer. So on the one hand, there is something about cold air that causes upper respiratory infections. And so that's why that's partly why they are worse in the winter. And the viruses themselves have genes which switch off when they were in warm air. And in that way, the infections stay up in your upper airways. And so you don't end up with them getting into the lungs and causing more severe illness because they just switch themselves off. And that's how they keep you well enough to spread, because that's like, you know, the virus, the genes in a virus are designed to be spread. That's all it cares about. It's going to evolve to spread. So it wants you up and about, coughing and sneezing on everybody, and or just breathing a lot into the air for the aerosols to spread. So that's one aspect of the humidity question. The other aspect is that you see these surges of influenza in Australia, in California, you don't see surges. So the textbook answer to why you have winter spread is that people huddle together indoors in the winter in indoor environments. But, you know, I've lived in New York for a bit. We did plenty of huddling together in the summer in air conditioned environments because it was too hot to be outside. And so you think, well, why doesn't it spread in the summer when everyone's huddled together then? You know, so I don't really buy the huddle together story at all. But I think the point is that, you know, if you can get it in Australia, then humidity, it doesn't have to be the kind of cold winter that we think of with colds. You know, you can get it in other places.
Here's a question that deals with that. So from Jeff Gonzalez says, how long would the COVID virus live in aerosol form? It seems in the sunlight and fresh air, it would die rather quickly. No?
That's a great question. Yeah. And so I'll go back to the sunlight thing. You know, if it's a very cloudy day, I think your UV exposure is going to be lower. And the viruses can end up on pollutants in the air, which sort of hide it from the UV. So that's why in more polluted areas, it spread more.
That's interesting, because I hadn't thought of it. It's a great question, right? So, because when you think about traveling hundreds of miles, maybe thousands, I don't know, like the Antarctica thing, the boat out at sea, I mean, that means the virus would have to travel through air while the sun is shining. Like, it seems unlikely, but it's seemingly that's the only explanation we have for why you have these long distance transmissions, right?
Well, there is one other explanation, which is a little bit out there. But I think, you know, as scientists, you listen to all hypotheses. And the other hypothesis is that it comes from space, right? There's fairly sound evidence base that there are viruses and bacteria that are just literally falling out of the sky. And people have collected over the sea viruses that they then managed to use to cause infections. So, you know, viable virus just appears in the air above the sea when there's nobody around. And likewise, in the mountains above Spain, they've done this similar experiment of collecting bacteria and viruses, like huge amounts of bacteria and viruses. And actually, there are some scientists like Fred Hoyle who've been talking about this for decades, talking about how actually a lot of material in space is viral and bacterial, and that it comes down from space. So that, you know, that is one explanation for how it does that. And the other is that it's going horizontally through the air. And to go back to the initial question, they did, experiments were done where if they would get these revolving drums, and in a revolving drum, you can get the sort of centrifugal force and the gravitational force to cancel out so that you can just hold these aerosols in place for a length of time. And the experiment that I was reading about at any rate only went up to 16 hours, but at 16 hours, there was still viable virus there. So in terms of just how long the aerosol can survive, it can survive a long, long time. So then it is just a UV light question.
Here's a question for you. And you know, we only got into one of your myths. You've got a whole book of myths. We have to have you back.
But we should be clear that Claire just said that the aliens are dropping viruses on us. Did I understand that correctly, Claire?
All right. Here's one. Annette Ruzewicz says, what happened to the acceptance of natural immunity? Why are we still running away from COVID?
That's so sad that what happened about that. I mean, it's so sad because people, like, we have amazing immune systems. They are just amazing. And they protect us all day long from all sorts of stuff that we're breathing in that, you know, you wouldn't want to think about. Like, the air is filthy if you look too closely. And our immune systems are incredible. And mostly none of this stuff really gets to even get into the sort of blood side of the immune system that most people write about. So our whole respiratory tract is lined with a thick layer of mucus. And the very last bit of mucus that's right by the cells is even thicker still. And on its own, a virus could not penetrate that. So the length of time it takes for a virus to get through that mucus, in that time, your cells have swept the mucus up and it's come back up and you've swallowed it into your stomach, into the acid, and it's dead. So there is, like, there's a kind of question mark there, like, how do these viruses get through the mucus? And the last mucus layer is too tightly knit to even let something as tiny as a virus through. And so there's one theory that they piggyback on bacteria. And so for a long time, people thought that influenza was caused by a bacteria. So there's a bacteria called Haemophilus influenzae, because people thought that was the cause of influenza. And the reason, it may be that the reason they thought it was a cause is because it was one of the things it was piggybacking off, and that they were often there hand in hand. And you know, you still see that now, that often influenza infections, then they're not on their own. There's been bacteria around. And so the bacteria, you see, they've got mechanisms of just, you know, they will just get themselves through because they're a cell that's got ways of moving and you know, using energy, whereas a virus is very passive. It can't do that.
I have a question that Paul and Pierre are going to jump on, because this comes from a viewer and says, you know, how, with what we're hearing, how can we use the iPrevent protocol from the FLCCC to avoid being infected with aerosolized COVID virus? And can you tell us how it works to prevent illness?
I mean, what I would say is that iPrevent is, you know, basically improving your immune system. We know vitamin D is so important. So basically, it's natural immunity is important. We know vitamin D deficiency is really impairs your immune system. So really, we're talking about ways to bolster your immune system so that you're much more effective in dealing with viral infections. There's no way you can remove aerosolized virus from
it's
the
all
air.
Out there. Yeah, get it.
That's just not possible. So, I mean, all you can, and you're going to breathe it in, all you can do is your immune system, as Claire said, is so brilliantly conceived that it will do its job. So what you want to do is just make sure you're not vitamin D deficiency, you're taking your vitamin C, you do oral hygiene. So these are really preventative measures and ways to improve your immune system. So Claire may want to talk about people on airplanes, because the air in an airplane is highly filtered and they have very efficient filtration systems. So as I understand, it actually is a very safe environment in an airplane. And yeah, so the idea of wearing a mask in an airplane is so absurd, unless you're going to put your head out the window.
What? Let me just put in one thing. So it is considered safe on an airplane because of their filter. But I was about to say, except for when it's not, because there have been some pretty dramatic super spreader events on airplanes. But now I'm rethinking that it could be some of what you're saying, Claire, is that they occurred at a time when it's, you know, the early onset of the wave, where a lot of people get infected early, and it just so happened that they attributed to the plane. But I do know of a number of events on planes where like a huge proportion of the patients on that plane were sick in the coming days.
I must say, when I go on flights, I do often end up with, you know, a cold afterwards. It's not uncommon, is it, to feel a bit better after?
But Pierre, you know, the problem is getting on the plane and off the plane. So I think, you know, the airport
that does that to us.
Yeah, so the air in the plane, I think, is pretty well filtered. The problem is, as soon as you step out of the gate, you expose to all these people congregated who are coughing and sneezing, and the air is full of bad stuff. And mm-hmm. So, you know, reading Claire's book, which is fascinating, is all, although you look and the air looks clean, it's actually full of bad stuff, which you can't see.
I want to add one thing to the last question. Is I think the question was around eye prevent and how can it help you. Besides everything that Paul said, you know, one of the mechanisms that we think that ivermectin works as a preventative is that it's been shown in a number of like molecular docking studies to bind very tightly to the spike protein. So if you're on ivermectin, you have some tissue or blood concentration of ivermectin, it's probably the reason why you're much less likely to get infected. But I do have to be humble about that. The data for prevention of ivermectin is so strong, but it's largely from the first year. And I don't know enough about the difference, but I do know, Claire, maybe you can correct me, but the variants do differ in terms of viral loads. And I thought they varied in terms of transmissibility, although I think tonight you're telling me that it's probably not true. But I think the viral loads, because I'll tell you, the ivermectin as a preventative in that first year, most people that I knew on ivermectin did not get COVID. I have some really interesting examples. I have a friend who runs a big company. He had like 100 people in his company on ivermectin because he knew the data. None of them got sick. But then as we moved into like late first year, second year, we started to see like breakthroughs. And I wasn't sure why ivermectin wasn't as preventative as we went on. And then Paul and I, we have to admit, we've been guessing at the preventative dose. At first, we were like, okay, let's do it twice a week. Let's go up to a little higher dose. And we really don't know. There's not really great data since that first year.
So I would say, I don't think that the variants can be all that different to each other, right? You know, they haven't got that many mutations in them. And the overall shape of each of the proteins within that virus has to be the same, or it won't be able to function. So there's a real, very, very narrow range of ways in which it can change. And so I can imagine maybe it could bind a bit tighter to a receptor, but the idea that it's going to have a massive impact on the clinical picture, I just don't quite buy. I think that gets used a lot as an excuse, actually, when people say, well, this one's more deadly and that one's more, well, I'm just not sure that's entirely true. I don't think you can blame the virus. And I think with your story about 100 people not getting it, I think it's important to try and imagine, you know, once you accept the fact that only 10% were susceptible, then if you've got a group of people who have worked together a long time, they may well have similar immunity to stuff because they've, you know, seen the same things in the past as well. So you kind of have to try and factor all of that into the sums. And then it becomes quite difficult to, you know, as an individual doctor, to try and get a handle on what's what's going on, because the numbers you need to start to get quite big.
Yep. Interesting.
By the way, it's 6 minutes after. Can you stay till 10 after?
Yeah.
Good. All of you. Okay. Here are a couple questions that deal with sort of the same thing. And given what you've said about it being all out there, the aerosol thing, it probably blows these away. But anyway, one viewer says, is proper ventilation of indoor spaces the best way to address this issue? Windows open and things like that? I'm going to guess no, based on what you just said.
Well, I say no, because you're going to get exposed anyway. You are going to get exposed. I think that's what's key. I guess one thing I haven't emphasized is the volume of virus out there. Like, it's just, you know, there's tons of it, tons and tons of it in the air. So you're not going to be able to avoid breathing it at some point during the wave.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's the other one from Craig, who says, as aerosol spread, doesn't the density and concentration diminish or dilute, and therefore the risk as well? Or is the issue that there are so many sources of the aerosol that dilution is limited?
No, he's absolutely right. Dilution is a critical point. So I think that, you know, the idea of that, some of the stories around close contact transmission come about because the nearer you are to someone who's infected, the higher dose you're going to get. And we've all got, you know, even people who might get away with it otherwise in a wave because they're immune, if you gave them a massive dose, then they're going to, you might be able to overcome that immunity. So, you know, it's always a balance between how immune you are and how much you've been exposed to. But the one of the really interesting parts for SARS-CoV-2 is that the sort of, for viruses generally, people have shown in the past that it only takes one viral particle to cause an infection. And with monkeypox, you needed way more to cause an infection than with SARS-CoV-2. So, you know, it's a very, very, very tiny dose can be enough. And of course, one viral particle, you'd get three or four viral particles in a single aerosol, or more, like way, way more. And actually, most of the viral particles are in the aerosol fraction of what you breathe out, not the droplet. So that was another thing people got confused about, because they assumed because the droplets are bigger, the concentration of virus would be higher in them. But actually, it's the other way around.
Okay, so Sarah in Texas says, is there ever a time when masks are called for? Now, Pierre found them valuable in the ER in certain circumstances, but for everyday people out there, the N95, if it's well fitted, I mean, worth it or forget it?
I think forget it. I think just forget it. I think I do agree about, you know, in a hospital environment where you've got sick people and you've got high dosage, you know, I think a hospital environment is a different story. But I would say that I think what we did broadly in hospitals, where everybody was wearing them all of the time, was just stripped healthcare of all of its humanity. You know, when people just see a sea of masked faces when they're at the most vulnerable, it's cruel, actually. And the communication deficit that you get with masking, when a lot of our patients are old and have hearing problems, just, you know, causes worse healthcare. So I think, you know, if you're in an ICU, if you're in an ER, that's a different story to if you're in a consultation with healthy doctor and a healthy patient who should be just looking at each other properly.
There's something different. Laura Emerson wants to know, does the term shedding relate to aerosol spread, or is it different? And why did we never hear the term shedding with other viruses?
Maybe I'll take that one. I don't know, Claire, if you're I'm kind of a little bit the resident shedding expert. So one thing real quickly, the word shedding has two meanings. Shedding has always been used in studying of viruses and transmission. So it's called viral shedding. And they even talk about the vaccinated and shedding of virus. When we're using shedding in COVID and around the vaccines, we use it to refer to the shedding of a gene therapy product, right? So the gene therapy, it's RNA, which is transcribed into a protein, and then that protein can be encapsulated in little lipid nanoparticles or exosomes, and they can be shed from one person to another. So that's not virus. Here we're talking about spike protein or mRNA that gets injected in people, and that can be transmitted. So there are two kind of contexts or definitions of shedding, and I think we need to be clear that Most of what we've been talking about, at least in our and what I've been writing about, is literally the shedding of gene therapy products, which is well known for gene therapies. It's part of that industry. Anytime you inject genetic material into someone and tell that human body to make a protein, that protein has the capacity of being shed to another person. And that's why some of us, like me, have really deep concerns about the whole gene therapy industry using lipid nanoparticles, because those little tiny lipid nanoparticles, they can cross numerous physiologic barriers. They can be exhaled or transmitted through the breath, sweat, tears, everything. But we think the predominant mode of transmission is through the breath. And unfortunately, I have to say, clinically, which is to say observationally, shedding is real. We see it in my practice. Myself and Scott, we treat shedding. We have numerous patients who cannot be around crowds of vaccinated. And it's a shame. The last thing I'll say about it is it's almost like, Claire, it's similar to like what you talked about in your book, which is the susceptibility to the virus. Same thing with shedding. Like it's literally it's a defined cohort. I don't know what the percentage is, but it's only a certain proportion of the population that is sensitive to the effects of the vaccine products from the vaccinated. It's not everyone. I mean, I'm around vaccinated for years. I don't have any symptoms, but I certainly have patients who are quite sensitive, and they can't really go to public places. Some of them can't go into grocery stores.
I've met people who've described the same to me as well. Yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting that like your 10% number, like I'm wondering, like for whatever reason, is there some reason to believe that it's 10% as well as far as in the shedding thing, but I don't know, I'm making it up.
We need to leave it there, but I think we ought to let Claire tell us again the title of the book and how many other myths do you have in there?
So there we go. It's called Expired, COVID, the Untold Story. It's on Amazon. And there are 12 myths in that book, all in. And so it covers, it's not just myths. What I did was try and tell the story through the psychology, what happened, how people were manipulated through the fear. And I tell a bit of my own story about how I sort of learned as I went along. The idea for the book started in 2021 when I realized that when I was talking to people and explaining one aspect of what had happened, I might get through to them, but it didn't fit with other things that they believed. And so then they would just go back to what they believed before. So I thought, well, the only way to actually explain it to people is to put it all in one place so that you need somebody's concentration span. They need a few hours. So I've put it all into a book so that it's all there. Instead of having little bits of jigsaw pieces, it's the puzzle complete.
Well, we thank you very much for staying up late in the UK to be with us. What time is it over there? It's really late, right?
It's past one. Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Claire. Oh. I really appreciate you understanding that it's so much better with you live and with an audience. I think it was great. You were awesome. So it was really great to talk. I learned so much.
Yeah, the good thing is Claire was alive. You were half dead. So it worked out okay.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah,
really, very grateful.
It was a pleasure, and I think a really good conversation.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. All right.
Very good. And thank you, doctors. Folks at home, I've got a few announcements. Don't go away. And we have another wonderful My Story coming up at the end. You learned something here tonight. Here we go. And come back same time next week, same place, when we are going to have Dr. Paul Marek and the wonderful Dr. Suzanne Gazda, who is neurologist extraordinaire, who many of you know by now, for an in-depth discussion on intermittent fasting and brain health. That will be next Wednesday, January 17th. You don't want to miss that one. The following week, January 24th, we'll have Dr. Marek back with Dr. Kathleen Ruddy for a discussion on another big important topic, alternative approaches to cancer. You don't want to miss any one of those. The week after, however, we will all be traveling to Phoenix for our third FLCCC educational conference. So please note, there will be no weekly webinar on January 31st. Now, speaking of the conference, the doctors I just mentioned, Suzanne Gazda, Kathleen Ruddy, as well as our own Paul Merrick, will all be featured speakers there, along with many other brilliant and compassionate medical and scientific experts. You can learn more about all the speakers, the panels, the topics, or register today at flccc.net/conference. Don't forget, this one is for everyone, not just doctors. We hope to see you there. And now, new episodes. In the meantime, Dr. Mobeen Syed, best known as Dr. Bean, and Dr. J.P. Salibi have new video talks to share with you. Learn more about how lactoferrin can potentially help fight acute COVID-19 infections. That's the topic of Dr. Bean's latest Long Story Short. And don't you just love his artwork there on that? It's just glorious cartoons. And then learn more about that odd condition of losing your sense of smell. Any of you have that happen when you got COVID? That will be on Monday's episode of Whole Body Health. You can find these at the links on the screen or on our FLCCC Alliance Rumble and Odyssey channels. And now then, did you ever think you'd see Doctors Joe Verone and Paul Merrick in leather bomber jackets? Neither do we, but here they are with photos to prove it, in case you haven't had a chance to check out all the new winter designs in our online store. Make sure to head over to supportflccc.store. And don't forget to use the code LETDOCTORSBEDOCTORS at checkout to receive a 10% discount. And with that, let's bring out Christina Morros, CRNA. She's our clinical specialist here and creative designer behind all of the apparel, and Samantha, the RN, who also answered the questions you posted into Q&A tonight. How did it go, nurses? How was it? Oh, you're muted. I can't hear you.
We had tons of questions on masks, Betsy.
Oh, I bet you did. I bet you did. Interesting stuff, right? Just getting into it in detail is fascinating. Stories there. Fascinating. And how are the bomber jackets selling?
Like hotcakes. You wouldn't believe it. They are the number one top seller because they're so cute for men and women.
Yeah, they are. They really are. Wonderful. They're not really that warm, though. You have to wear a big sweater underneath it, right?
No, they're warm. They have this nice little jersey lining.
Ooh, good, yeah. Good. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for being here and doing all of this wonderful, intelligent work that from your own clinical experience and training that is just so valuable for all of us. Thank you. Thank you. And I have to say thank you, folks, for all of you out there, for joining us on this incredible journey, for sharing this vital information with your friends and family, for learning with us, for helping us empower more people to regain control of their health and flourish. Thank you. Thank you for helping us reach more, do more. You know, there's absolutely no way that we could do this without you, our dear FLCCC family. We will see you next week. But first, a short reminder of what's coming up in Phoenix, and followed by another just wonderful, deeply interesting kind of a story, a my story. That's what keeps us all going, hearing from you as well. Thank you. See you next week.
The goal of all of this is just central to what we do. I mean, we're trying to help patients.
This is the battle to restore medicine to its original purpose.
This is the population of people that is creating a functional healthcare system parallel to the healthcare system that has failed us.
Hi, I'm Jay. Very early in the pandemic, I read that residents of China already taking hydroxychloroquine for lupus and other diseases were not getting COVID or not getting a bad case. This began a time-wasting period of doing nothing but internet searches. Finally, in the fall of 2020, I heard of the FLCCC and found Dr. Salibi. and received a prescription for ivermectin, and I started with the entire iPrevent protocol. With the exception of iodine nasal and throat preventive treatment, which we've used from mid-2020, my wife chose not to follow a protocol. We both had the jabs and the booster, but stopped at 3 shots. No ill effects, but doubts about efficacy and safety were beginning to surface. We both went COVID-free for all of 2020, 2021, and 2022. When the FLCCC removed ivermectin from the iPrevent protocol, I stopped taking it, but did continue with all of the balance of the protocol. In February of 2023, my wife went out of town for one night, returned on a Saturday. During the night on Saturday, my wife had terrible chills and woke on Sunday feeling awful. So Sunday morning, my wife decided to take a COVID test. She was positive. Then I took the test, but I was negative. Dr. Salibi's office recommended that I immediately start the treatment protocol, including ivermectin. I did so, and my wife, who by now was feeling really sick, said yes to the ivermectin as well as the entire treatment protocol. While she did have a fever, over the course of the next 6 days, she slept well, and the aches and chills were no worse than a mild case of flu after the first few days on the protocol. She also slept a lot. I never tested positive, never had a fever, and never felt the least bit ill. I attribute her mild case and quick positive outcome to her taking the entire treatment protocol, and I attribute my not even getting COVID to being on the entire treatment protocol preceded by the entire prevent protocol. Since I'm 75 years old, I feel very fortunate to have found the FLCCC and to have followed their advice. My wife and I are now both on the complete iPrevent protocol and intend to stay there. Lastly, since starting the iPrevent in 2020, I have not been sick with any disease whatsoever. Thank you, FLCCC.